and welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast for two siblings who love books. Uh-oh, not prepared.
Before we started, I was like, uh-oh, Gab's quick, think of something. No! Words are all I have to go on. Wrong play, whatever.
I love books so much, I dress up as a woman to make books like me better. I dress up as a book to make books like me better.
Dress up as a man to write books.
I cross garter myself. I'm wearing my best yellow pants for the
evening. Tony is already regretting his decision to be on our show.
They might revoke my PhD.
Yes, if anybody hears this. Fortunately for you, we have no listeners.
It's true. Like, what? Adam's listening. Jessica's listening.
Hi, Jessica.
Probably about it.
Probably.
Maybe Amy.
So, yeah, this week on Novel Ideas.
Gas coughs.
I've spent so much time editing Gab's coughing out of our last few episodes. It's ridiculous.
It's almost done now.
Well, she's been in a hot box for so long.
That's right. So, anyway.
Yeah, this week we read Twelfth Night by William Shakespeare.
Night.
Scott and I actually had a big conversation on how to pronounce twelfth.
Twelfth night.
Because there's a lot of sounds in such a short word.
There are.
Like twelve. So yeah, we read Twelfth Night by William Shakespeare.
And we brought aboard special guest, Tony Funari.
Hello.
Dr. Anthony Funari.
That's right.
Thank you.
PhD.
Hey, are we going to give the familiar name and then we'll give the credentials? So yes, this will be an unusual episode of Novel Ideas because someone here will actually know things.
I know things sometimes.
I know things. They're just, none of them are useful or relevant.
Oh, a PhD in literature? Useful? Relevant?
When you're discussing Shakespeare.
Oh, well, yeah, yes. I mean.
Oh, okay.
When you're doing this episode else, of Novel Ideas.
Yes. You're like buttoning buttons or balancing a checkbook. Maybe not so much.
Getting a job.
Getting a job. Yeah.
Especially that last one.
I don't need a job. I'm intelligent.
I don't need a full-time job when the community college will pay me literally hundreds of dollars a year to be an adjunct.
Ouch. Damn.
When I graduate, I'll just start publishing all your books.
Well, there we go.
Don't worry about it.
Oh, good.
So, yeah, we picked this play because we decided to do kind of a little play kick. We wanted to have Tony as a guest, so we decided, you know, read some Shakespeare, and he's qualified to talk about that. And Twelfth Night is actually one of the plays I wrote about for my undergraduate English thesis, so we thought if Tony couldn't make it, then at least I would kind of know what I was talking about.
And I've never read the play until 2 days ago, so those are my credentials. So, you know,
Ben's just being as useful as always.
Ben's comic relief. He's the Sir Toby.
Exactly.
You are Sir Toby.
Toby Belch.
I'm Sir Toby Belch. I'll see if I can work up some gas.
Congratulations. Shouldn't be too hard for you.
Par for the course.
So the genre of this play...
Well, since you said of this play, I guess it's not a play. Or the genre is not a play. It's a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Comedies, I think we talked about this probably with Merchant Events a little bit, but comedies typically end in weddings.
Weddings. Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of joke is, you know, comedies end in weddings and tragedies end in death. Mm-hmm. And that's how you can tell the two apart.
Right.
Which is actually sometimes kind of true.
And interesting enough, some tragedies sometimes even begin with a wedding.
Yeah.
Hamlet, for example.
They begin with order and move to disorder. And comedy start with disorder
and move to order.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a whole entropic thing going on.
Yeah.
Nice.
And we will talk about a little bit about how Twelfth Night does not quite fit the comedy bill all the way, but it is definitely considered one of Shakespeare's comedies.
Yeah.
So. Plot synopsis.
Let's see, what do we end up going with? Oh, right, OMG Twins.
I just like that plot synopsis because it's really dumb.
It's just one of the dumber ones we've cooked up. Well, that's not entirely true. The dumbest ones we've cooked up are summarily rejected by Gabs after they fall out of my mouth when we're outlining.
And Ovenchi Twins just works for me for some reason, because, I mean, that is kind of the, like, whole crux of the play does pretty center much, yeah. around the twins.
Well, the fifth act exists because of twins.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Twins!
Twins! Twins! But I'm just saying, like, I know Ben and I aren't twins, but you know, no male and female twins are identical. So if Ben and I crash landed somewhere and I, like, dressed up as a man, like, no one would mistake me for Ben. I don't know.
Right. I mean, before you even factor in the facial hair right. and the extra 100 pounds.
Right.
Yeah, and I mean, I know some of it is, you know, the illusion of theater, because a lot of times when you watch these plays on stage, like, Viola will, like, put on a hat and right, be like, yeah. I'm a man now.
Or fake mustache.
Yeah.
Or just like how Gwyneth Paltrow is a totally convincing boy in Shakespeare in Love.
Right.
Where did she put her hair? It pisses me off so bad. Like, her hair is up in that fucking wig.
I think she stowed it in her vagina.
I mean, at least in the 12th night version, movie version, they she cut actually cuts her hair.
Yes.
Like, she's more dedicated to the act.
Wore a big floppy hat.
She did wear a hat.
And I guess, like, one of the things with cross-dressing in Shakespeare's time is because everyone was, like, supposed to wear, like, a set costume.
Right.
You know, like, if you were in a certain social structure or a certain gender, you were
the sumptuary laws.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, putting on breeches, people would just be like, oh, you're a man now.
Well, yeah, and also, for most of your infancy and childhood, boys and girls would be dressed the same. And
right.
there was a real big to-do called the breeching when a young boy would be given his first pair of breeches. This kind of signaled his transition into manhood.
Yeah, if you look at old paintings of, like, you know, aristocrats and their kids, they're not just with, like, a bunch of daughters, like,
no,
sons wore dresses.
Exactly, exactly. And so it really, clothing was a really important gender marker.
Yeah, and so I think, you know, if you saw this play back when it was written, you'd just be like, oh, okay, Viola put on boys' clothes, people
right.
think she's a boy now, because
yeah.
it meant more than well, in modern day, you're like, how is she getting away with that?
I would say the modern trope still kind of exists, well, at least if you're an anime fan like I am, but there are a lot of shows where some girl shows up dressed in a boy's uniform and no one can tell the difference.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, Japanese teenagers are not that androgynous.
I just have to imagine that all of Shakespeare's heroines must, like, not have double D boobs, because you could not get away with. You just have to bound
that. Just wrap
that.
Them up real
right.
tight.
Can't breathe.
They bind them.
Yeah, that would not feel good.
No.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of hard to give a brief summary because, like, a ton of crap happens in this play.
Yeah, I guess you could say there's, like, three major subplots.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have the Olivia, Viola, and Orsino quasi-love triangle.
Mm-hmm.
You have the whole comedic subplot of Toby, Andrew Egucheek, Malvolio, and Mariah, and Fabian.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also have the subplot of Antonio and Sebastian going on.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And circulating around all of these, or going through all these different subplots, is the Fool Festy.
Right, he shows up in all of them.
He shows up in all of them.
Mm-hmm. He's the transcendent character.
He
gets to cross the streams or whatever. What the fuck?
Cross the drama stream.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's very true. For most of the play, those three plot lines are very separate from each other.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was thinking, when you talk about this play or just kind of hear about this play, you mostly hear about Viola dressing up as a boy, and then Orsino and Olivia.
Mm-hmm.
And you could probably, like, hear someone talk about this play for 20 minutes and never even hear them mention, like, the Toby-Andrew
probably, yeah.
subplot,
but
which is still really important.
Right.
But people get really caught up on that that love triangle, I think.
And the most famous line comes from the subplot. You know, some are born great, some achieve greatness, and some have greatness thrust upon them. Okay?
I was surprised to see that in there. I had no idea that was from this play.
Yes.
And when taken out of context, means something entirely different.
Yes, it does.
I actually love that that's in that letter to trick Malvolio and... the other, like, how in the Hamlet, all of, like, Polonius's, phrases are now these, like, taken as these wise words of wisdom, but that character's actually, like...
incredibly
talking
conceited.
Out his ass.
Well, he's also very... He's also, you know, always about, you know, just protect yourself. Okay?
Yeah.
It's really interesting how so many of Shakespeare's more famous lines, when you actually read them in context, mean something completely
different.
You're like,
that's not inspirational.
No, not at all.
That guy's a dumbass.
Because when Malvolio is re-quoting the greatness line, everyone's just pointing at him and laughing.
He's
like,
exactly.
You idiot, why would you take that seriously? That's not a thing.
He's saying that to Olivia, and she's like, whoa.
Yeah.
He went crazy.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
This is why nobody likes you, Malvolio.
Yeah, so you essentially have, like, kind of the love triangle plot with Viola Orsino and Olivia, and then you have the, like, getting back at the jackass plot line with Malvolio and Toby Belch and company, and then the Sebastian Antonio thing is, like, a... Well, I don't know. They're just kind of trying to... Antonio's trying to get some... Sorry. I was actually rereading through part of my thesis because I was writing about queer spaces in this play, and I have this whole like disclaimer at the beginning where I'm like, you know, with queer theory you can interpret the play to open up queer spaces and interpretations, but you're not actually identifying any of the characters as gay or straight or saying like they have to be that way or like saying Shakespeare intended it to be that way. So I was trying to say, like, Shakespeare didn't want Antonio to be gay. Shakespeare wasn't gay. Like, that's not what I'm arguing. But then, like, when I just talk about the play, I'm like, Antonio's totally gay. Like, my academic half and my this half.
Your fangirl half? I don't know.
Are ridiculous. But anyway, we'll talk more about all of that later. Setting.
Illyria. In Shakespeare contemporary times.
But, it was written as, like, contemporary to the time it was written, but you can perform it...
anytime, really.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily have to be Illyria, which is, you said, the Baltics?
The Balkans.
Balkans. There.
So having, having a count as an important political figure might feel a little weird if you tried to set it in 2014, but you could really still do it. You could just make him a CEO or something.
Right.
Well, I mean, like, because Illyria is kind of this, like,
mythical
island. Yeah, it's kind of this magical place that's not really tied into... It's not set in London.
Mm-hmm.
Or Venice.
Set.
Yeah.
So it does kind of have that, like, nebulous quality that allows you to put it anytime, because it's not actually tied to, like, the real world.
Right. I mean, Illyria is a region that is kind of defined by the ancient Romans, and it's even then kind of up in the air. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, for all intents and purposes, this could be taking place on the island of Heaven or something like that.
Yeah.
To, like, The Tempest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And
this actually took place on the same island as And Then There Were None.
Mm-hmm.
On Soldier Island.
Yes. Many years or previously.
Well, I mean, it could. That's also kind of, you know, weird mythical island place, so. Okay, and then we don't really have point of view tense because, as we say, every time we discuss a play, plays are always present tense and, like, all of the characters are just talking, so.
It'd be weird if it wasn't.
Yeah.
I mean, how would you even do that?
Not in present tense.
You'd have to have a narrator step in and say, this is what happened. But then it'd be a flashback that was still in present tense.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, Tennessee Williams does that.
Yeah.
Glass Menagerie.
Yeah.
But it still feels like present tense when you watch it.
Yeah,
yeah. And you can sometimes have plays, like, from a point of view if there's, like, one character that's just, like, in every scene or is, like, stepping aside and narrating to you. But,
Could you have people just each standing in their own light without a set and be having the light come on when they're giving their dialogue and it switches off and every time they say their dialogue, they're like, I said, happily.
If you want to write the worst play ever.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Well, you know.
That's kind of what I'm saying, though.
No, Richard III does that, in a way.
Well,
because he has all those asides that he's kind of narrating for the audience exactly what he's doing. Well, he says to the audience, hey, this is what I'm going to do, and watch how I do it, and he does it, and they say, hey, wasn't that funny when I did it?
That's how you make it, like, from his point of view, and right. I understand that's good, but what Ben is saying no. is, like, to make it in the past tense by saying, like, the character's dialogue, yeah. and, like, I said that.
Right.
I did that.
I'm setting up, like, the worst modern theater experiment yeah. in the history
gonna,
of
like,
experiments.
I was going to, like, actually say yeah. that the first half of Richard III, I would argue, is actually from his point of view.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure there are plays out there where, like, all the action is, like, warped through one character's, mm-hmm. like, brain. So
right.
Right.
it's not impossible. It's just, but they kind of do have to be present tense. That's kind of the point of them. Like, none of the characters interact. They just stand there and stare straight ahead.
And, like, and narrate to the audience their own dialogue, yeah.
That would be, like, some shitty experimental play you would
right.
see on, like, off-Broadway. Right. Yeah.
Somebody's studio apartment.
Yeah.
Like, 10 people wedged against one wall.
So,
second worst play ever.
Second worst?
Yeah.
So, who is the protagonist of Twelfth Night?
Well, clearly Viola is our heroine.
The Shakespeare comedic heroine.
Heroine, yes. Mm-hmm.
You want to talk a little bit about comedic heroines, Tony?
I would love to, okay? This is kind of typical for more later Shakespeare comedies, such as You Like It, where we have the cross-dressing woman comes in and restores order, or even Merchant of Venice, where we see the same thing of Portia coming mm-hmm. in, a cross-dressed, restores order. This kind of speaks to how Shakespeare gives a lot of power to his female protagonists and heroines.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that's unusual for, like, playwrights of his time? Like, if you were a actress and you wanted to act plays from his time, like, would you have more luck being in a Shakespeare play? Or?
Yeah, he typically for comedies you go. There's more powerful roles for women in Shakespeare's than in any of his other contemporaries. To be honest, the only other one that I could think of is The Duchess of Malfi by John Webster, but that was more of a tragedy. And that is a really great role for a woman. But typically, Shakespeare has the best heroines
okay.
of his time.
So that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, Viola kind of has the nice perspective of, like, coming in on these sort of ridiculous people in this mm-hmm. ridiculous situation and kind of calling them out on their
yeah.
shit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It actually kind of always baffled me a little bit why she fell in love with Orsino. Because she seems to be way smarter than him.
It seems like all of the parts that would have led her to that happened before the play actually started.
Yeah.
They happened in 11th Night.
But she doesn't meet him until this play.
She's heard of him, though.
Right.
Her father has spoken of Duke Orsino.
Dork Orsino.
That works so well.
It does.
Possible episode title.
Well, in our college comedy version of Twelfth Night, his name will be changed to Dork
Orsino. He's like the legacy kid who's kind of dumb, but he likes the
but
hot
he's
girl.
Emo.
Yeah.
He loves being sad. But she's heard of Duke Orsino before. Why she falls in love with him? Just convenient for the play.
Yeah, convenient
really.
For the plot.
Because
yeah.
you have to tie, everybody has to couple up at the end.
Right.
So there you go.
Maybe he's hot too.
Yeah.
Maybe he is.
Maybe he is.
So, I don't know, let's talk a little bit more about Viola.
Mm-hmm.
So, like Tony said, she decides to cross-dress, and I mean, mm-hmm. everyone, well, I don't know if everyone knows this, I guess I shouldn't say that in Shakespeare, but one of the popular things that people know is, like, when a woman cross-dresses in a Shakespeare play, she was actually a boy actor,
right.
cross-dresses a woman, cross-dressing as a man. So you have that
right.
multiple layers mm-hmm. of hilarity
mm-hmm.
that Shakespeare freaking loves.
Yeah. Kind of just to draw your attention, yes, you're actually watching a boy play a girl who's playing a boy, so on and so forth.
So this actually is kind of meta.
Yeah, actually it is. Well, there's even that point where Fabian says in Act 3 or 4, I think it's Act 4, yes, if this was performed on a stage, I would condemn it as a work of improbable fiction.
Yes.
I tweeted that one, actually.
Well done.
Yes. Yeah, I was like, hey!
Yeah, because this is as they're pulling the trick on Malvolio. So yes, there's always, in Shakespeare, he's always reminding the audience, yes, you're watching a play.
Right.
He never wants you to forget that fact.
Fourth wall humor.
Yeah, exactly.
And as you were saying, how Twelfth Night is part of the, the 12th day of Christmas, part
celebration
of, like,
the festivities.
And I was reading somewhere that, like, Twelfth Night, the play, could be performed on Twelfth Night, like, as a form of entertainment. So that's also kind of like a little meta thing thrown in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Shakespeare's hyper aware that he's on stage and wants everyone to do
it. So it's not the 12th installment in a popular Elizabethan drama franchise, is what you're saying.
Not quite.
Modern Hollywood just led me astray.
They would totally do that. It was 12th Night 2. Malvolio's Revenge.
10th Night is where Antonio and Orsino form their rivalry.
Yeah, there you go.
9th Night was Viola's dad hanging out with Orsino's dad and learning of his awesome son.
Well, which one does... I guess Olivia's brother has to die at the end of 11th Night. They're like at his funeral. This one, right?
That's right. So 11th Night is a tragedy. 10th Night is a comedy. 9th Night, tragedy. 8th Night, tragifarce.
7th Night, partridge in a pear tree.
So the other thing about Viola... that Tony was talking about while we were outlining that I thought was really cool that I wanted to talk about is how she is always in liminal spaces.
Yeah.
So she at the beginning of the play, she actually is like a woman, and then she dresses as a boy, and then she is dressed as a boy for the rest of the play.
Yeah.
So like typically, like in As You Like It, Rosalind, is dressed as a boy in the middle of the play, and then at the end she gets back into the dress, and then she gets married, and then we have the order and the happy marriage and all this stuff. But at the end of the play, we just have the promise that Viola's going to change back into her clothes, and then she and Orsino are going to get married, but it doesn't actually...
It's not actually staged for us,
right?
It's just something that's put off to the future, okay? Dependent on that, Malvolio releases the sea captain who has Viola's clothing. Yeah.
So she's kind of neither man nor woman at that point.
She's in between. As she describes herself, she's a monster. She's neither male nor female here. And she's constantly in these in-between states. She goes in between Orsino's court and Olivia's house. She's, when we see her, she's in between lands. She's cast away on a shore. So she's not in her homeland. She's not exactly in Illyria yet, but she's in between. Okay? And even her age, the way Malvolio describes it, she's neither a boy nor a man. So in this sort of in-between state.
I think that's really interesting.
So the conventions of the day have been, I guess kind of similar to now, actually, where audiences would have been a little freaked out by an ambiguous ending. Would that have been considered an ambiguous ending?
Oh, yeah. I would say, it would have been. And Shakespeare is it's not uncommon in Shakespeare to have those ambiguous endings of Love's Labor Lost. Okay? We don't get marriage at the end.
Right.
Or Measure for Measure.
Yeah.
Okay.
One of
the problem plays where we're not sure whether I forget the protagonist, the heroine in that comedy. Elizabeth?
No. Isabel?
Isabel. Thank you. Yeah, it's Isabel. We're not sure if she's actually going to marry the Duke or not.
Right. Or she's going to go back to her.
Right. I've seen a stage where she's just on stage looking at the audience saying, why do I have to deal with this again?
Well, yeah, isn't it basically like that one ends with the Duke like, hey, let's get married, but she like never actually says anything.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it's not uncommon for Shakespeare to leave us with a cliffhanger. The problem plays is what they're referred to as.
Yeah. And this one can kind of be considered kind of on the edge of that. Although it does imply, like, they're going to get married, and although we are left with the Malvolio. Oh, yeah. And let's go ahead and talk about Malvolio, because he's very important to the whole structure of the play. So, I mean, first of all, there's just his name.
Which translates literally to ill wishes.
Yeah, and he starts out as just a high and mighty jackass. Well, he's super serious, like, full of himself.
Yeah, he's totaler, preening.
Preening Puritan. He's literally regarded as a Puritan. He's the steward of Olivia's household, which is a high-ranking position, actually, among her servants. He would have been in charge of basically everything that had to do with all of her household dealings.
And he hates her uncle.
Her uncle.
Toby Belch, who, like, just likes to carouse and drink and sing and fuck around, essentially, and do nothing all the time.
In the college comedy, he'd be the overweight, bearded bro guy.
Zach Galifianakis.
Right, has been on campus a few years too long.
Like, dude, when are you going to graduate? I don't know, like 5 years.
Yeah. When I'm done partying, man, what will that be? Never, bro.
So, Malvolio just... Toby and all the people who surround Toby just completely infuriate him because, you know, he's uptight Puritan man, and they're all, like, drinking bros. And so they decide to take Malvolio down a notch and basically prank him.
Right.
So he learns to be less full of himself, essentially.
Yeah. They get Mariah to write a letter in... Olivia's handwriting, basically, saying that, Malvolio discovers and picks up, thinks it quite might be for him, not sure, opens it up, reads it, and decides this is a love letter to him from Olivia, saying how much she loves him, and that if you love me too, you'll show me by wearing yellow stockings and coming cross-guarded and smiling all the time, because your smiles become you.
Yeah.
Which I assume is the 2014 equivalent of wandering around in, like, a flowy blouse and bell-bottoms.
Pretty much.
Looking like a complete dope.
Yeah.
Really looking flamboyant and out of time. Was cross-guarding the thing that was popular, like, 50 years before that or something?
Not that I'm aware of.
I think that's just, like,
What is cross-guarding?
Well, I guess, essentially, is where, you know, your socks have, you know, the garters holding them up, and you just sort of spin them a bit. So it forms a cross around your different calf.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. It's like some people do, where you kind of have, like, the crisscross ties up the legs.
I see.
And, like, part of it is that Olivia's brothers, you know, has died, and she's, like, in this melancholy state where she's like, I'm going to be in mourning for 7 years, and Malvolio is, like, super serious, like, uptight man, which she, like, actually kind of likes. She's like, you know, call Malvolio here because I'm depressed, and he's always good at being a stick in the mud. And then he shows up, and he's, like, grinning and, like, being super upbeat, and... They're like, what is wrong with you?
Well, yeah, he's the total opposite of Festi. I mean, we have these two polar forces in the play. You know, Malvolio, ill-tent, someone who's serious, somber, is, you know, curmudgeon.
Never wants anyone to have any fun.
No fun whatsoever, puritanical, versus Festi, who's, you know, like his name says, he's about the festival. He's about the carnival aspect. He's about the holiday, okay? About bringing some foolery, some laughter into this world. And if we notice, at the beginning of the play, it's referred to that Festi has been absent for a long time. Hence, suggesting, you know, the world of Illyria has been very depressing.
It needs some lightening
up. Yeah. It needs some Ben.
That's right. Ben is here. Festi is here. And refuses to take your conversation seriously, no matter what it is.
Yeah, no matter what you say.
But I'll sing a stupid song.
The songs are all commentary, too, though.
Yeah.
Wow. And that's, I mean, music is an important part of the play. Yeah. So, Yeah, and so Malvolio's whole thing is he just gets completely ridiculed and torn down to, like, the lowest level. And at the end, when everyone has, you know, decided to, I guess, like, be on Festy's side. Get married, be happy.
Festy,
like,
wins at the end.
Yeah. Then Malvolio's kind of just kicked out of their happy little
group. Yeah, but he'll say he'll have his revenge on them.
Yes.
He says he will.
Yeah. Which is another part of the ending that's left open. Is he says, I will be revenged on the pack of you all, and leaves. And then we're just like, oh, that's
not good.
What's he going to do?
12th night 2.
Malvolio's revenge.
Cross-guarded, bitch.
I'll cross-guard you. So,
star-crossed gartered lovers. Malvolio and Olivia. Bam, nailed it.
Swish.
So the whole question with Malvolio, was he justly punished and now he's gonna run off and like whatever, or did maybe it get taken a step too far and someone needs to go, you know, apologize to him?
Well, what are his sins?
Well, he's a preening jackass.
Which is not a sin in and of itself.
Well, it's annoying.
It's annoying. Okay.
He's self-important.
Self-love.
He looks down on people who aren't, who don't believe what he believes, basically.
Right.
The idea of marrying Olivia is really appealing to him because he wants to have more power.
He's a social climber.
I was going to say, in the context of the play, probably, in the times, we come across as extremely presumptuous.
Yes. Yeah. This was being performed in front of an aristocratic audience. So here you have a character who's presuming to be able to move up in the social hierarchy.
The steward's not going to marry the lady of the house, you ridiculous Malvolio.
Exactly.
That's not going to happen.
So, in some ways, he's kind of, for them, he's justly punished. I mean, it's the same kind of thing you have to see with Shylock. Is Shylock justly punished at the end?
Well, right. To like a modern day audience, you're like, oh, that's pretty fucked up.
Right.
So my argument with Malvolio is that taking him down a peg was definitely a good idea. And the way they were doing it and just making him look absurd walking around cock of the walk was very fitting.
Well, especially because that letter wasn't even straight up like, Malvolio, this is Olivia, I love you. It was like full of nonsense and he decided to interpret it.
Right. They let him jump to his own conclusions. Mm-hmm. And to me, that would have been really funny if he had gone to Olivia, declared his undying love in front of everybody, and then they pulled the rug out from underneath him. I would have enjoyed that a lot. When it got to the point of, throwing him in the cellar and making him think they were going to burn him at the stake, I started to think that was a little too much.
It is kind of funny when they're making him think that he's actually possessed. Out hyperbolic fiend, thou talks nothing of late but of ladies. That's hilarious.
But, I mean,
And I did like Festy having a conversation with himself as the judge and the clown. Yeah,
that was awesome.
That was funny.
It's pretty good stuff.
He sounds like he's possessed. What do you mean, Judge? He's too dumb to be possessed. No, he's definitely possessed. We must burn him.
I don't know what you mean. So you see, you get those rich comedic moments then by really torturing him.
Oh, I mean, yeah, there was some of that. So, I mean, the thing is with that scene is, depending on how you decided to stage it, it could really set the tone of what you're going to take out of it.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, you could say that for any play, really, right? Every scene in every play. One of the things with this play is that I have never seen the play staged. Mm-hmm. I've just read it, and even reading it, there are a couple moments where I laughed aloud, but some of these scenes I could definitely tell. Yeah, if this was done well by people who knew what they were doing, it would be really funny.
Yeah.
I've seen the version where, you know, they have them, locked in the cellar, and basically, just chained up, in a prison. Right. And then when he shows up at the end, he's, in the ragged clothes, and he hasn't eaten,
he's a little pissed.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you're like, that was kind of shitty to do to somebody.
And, you know, and even Olivia says he has been most notoriously abused. used. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there is some sympathy towards him at the end.
Yeah, so it's kind of that mix of like, well, yeah, he deserved it, but at the same time, like, maybe they could have been a little...
It makes a little bit of that prejudicial thing where, because he's the Puritan, and, mm-hmm. you know, if you were a drama person, they would represent yeah. everything that is bad mm-hmm. to you. Mm-hmm. They're like, yeah, we're going to punish this guy freely and not worry about whether it goes too far because he wants to end us.
Yeah.
Well, it's a little, I mean, Merchant of Venice, like you mentioned, so Shylock gets punished, and, like, most of them seem pretty self-satisfied, and, like, he deserved it, and, right. like, to some degree, he was a jackass, and, like... Yeah. took it too far, but then you have, like, so in this play, Olivia says, well, you know, he was wronged, and then mm-hmm. in The Merchant of Venice, there's the point where, like, Jessica, his daughter who ran away, like, mm-hmm. basically stops talking and doesn't comment on right. it, and we don't know if she's, like, really upset and, mm-hmm. like, doesn't actually agree that he deserved it, and, like, maybe that's commentary within the play.
Then. It could be, yeah.
Like, Shakespeare kind of noting, like, okay, like, maybe it did go a step too far, but without actually directly, you know, mm-hmm. making a thing out of it.
Right.
So, mm-hmm. it is kind of an interesting open end there, and it doesn't get solved, so. Nope. Huh? Okay, let's go talk about Orsino and Olivia. Those who are living on Illyria. Because they're kind of similar.
They are. I mean, both suffer from a type of melancholia. Okay.
Although Olivia's feels a little more deserved because she, like, her family just died.
Right.
Yeah.
And Orsino's just like, oh, I love you.
But she doesn't become really so much melancholy from her brother and father passing away. She becomes melancholy from Cesario rejecting her.
Yeah, definitely.
Right. Mm-hmm. And there is an element to the grief part even that seems like she's playing it up just a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, it's one thing to go, I'm sad because my father and brother just died and I'm going to be in mourning for a while. It's another to say, I'm not going to look at a man for 7 years.
And she's obviously not very serious about that because as soon as right. Cesario shows right. up, she's like throwing herself
she's
at
like,
him.
She's like, Bonzo!
Elegantly. Thank you, Ben.
Practically Shakespeare.
That's right.
Shakespeare was alive today.
No, he was... He wasn't opposed to a little bit of ribaldness here and
no,
there.
No, not by a long shot. That's true.
So, yeah, Orsino's kind of in the category the in love with being in love. So he's not necessarily, like, super in love with Olivia, the person. Like,
right.
oh, we used to hang out all the time and now I love you. It's just like, oh, like... She's hot, and mm-hmm. I want to be in love with somebody, so...
Right, and he constantly just sends emissaries to her.
Yeah.
I mean, even the first person he sends to her, his name is Valentine. He's sending her a Valentine.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
and,
yeah.
And you get a good idea of how ridiculous, like, he's being right off the bat, because the first speech is, you know, if music... Which, another really famous line, if music be the food of love, play on... But then, by the end of the speech, she's like, stop playing that!
Right.
I don't want to hear it anymore.
Yeah. It's just not as sweet as it was before.
Yeah, he's really kind of fickle and like...
Oh, God, yeah. Well, again, that which would have been a symptom of melancholy.
Yeah. So, yeah, Orsino's just kind of depressed himself. And he's using kind of the same tired lines over and over again. Mm-hmm. And Cesario's... You know, catching Olivia's attention is because he actually busts out of the rote stuff right. and starts saying, original, you know, oh, I've bust down your door and, like, not refuse to leave and all this stuff. And she's like, well, I've never heard anyone talk like that before.
Yeah, I mean, Viola introduces some life into this world.
Mm-hmm, like, sincere passion as opposed to just
feigned. Well, not so much feigned, but artificed.
Like, I read this poem, and it's really beautiful, and it describes how I feel for you. As opposed to just telling someone how you feel.
Right. Well, just Duke Orsino is the original emo kid. He is emo.
Yeah. Yeah. He totally is. Okay. Let's see. Who else we got? Well, we were talking a little bit about... We talked about Festi a little bit. Mm-hmm. Antonio, I guess, like... His claim to fame is mostly that he's, like, super dedicated to Sebastian. Mm-hmm. And that also helps drive part of the plot towards the end.
Yeah.
Because, he was basically... Is he a pirate? Or,
yeah, well, you know, pirate is a relative term, right?
Yeah.
I mean, from his country, he is probably seen as someone who's defending against Orsino's navy.
I was going to say, it's the whole terrorist freedom fight argument.
Exactly.
And I do remember from my Roman history that Illyria was a region that was rife with piracy, so I don't know if that continued in the later
pirates,
times.
Yeah. Right. And it kind of, because it sounded like, you know, he said, oh, well, Orsino's gonna arrest me if he finds me, and Sebastian's like, oh, you, like, kill a bunch of guys? And he's like, well, I didn't really kill anyone. I just kind of took their stuff.
Yeah.
I might have stolen a whole ship full of treasure.
Right.
So he seems like a fairly, I mean, like, as far as pirates go, he's not that bloodthirsty.
Right.
Just kind of doing his thing.
Although, what, Duke Orsino's nephew did lose his leg at that battle that Antonio's involved with. And it kind of suggested that Antonio might have been the one that took it.
Or maybe it was just a cannonball throwing a giant deck splinter into his leg.
Yeah.
But I think you could still argue the guy who commanded the ship to fire was somewhat responsible for that. I'm taking your treasure. No, you're not. Well, we're going to fire our cannons. Oh, you lost the bottom half of it. That's totally not my fault. Yeah, someone's still going to blame me for that.
Right, so Antonio saved Sebastian from the shipwreck, and you know, he loves him so much and so dedicated to him that he's just going to follow him despite this danger to himself.
Mm-hmm. And he also gives him his purse.
Right, gives him money to go off and,
you know, buy a trinket here or there. You know.
And that
buy yourself something nice.
Yeah,
exactly. Something pretty.
Yeah, well, and so, I mean, just bringing in a little bit of my English thesis. It's like, in like a modern day play, like one of the ways you might write like a gay character, not saying Antonio's gay, but like, you know, if someone's in love with someone else, like, you might write a gay character kind of like prissy. That's kind of like the new stereotype is like, oh, like, gay guys are wusses and stuff. Whereas, like, in this play, it's more like Orsino's kind of like the lounging wuss, even though he's like pining after a woman. He's being a little more feminine and passive.
Yeah.
And Antonio, who, you know, we don't know if he's in love with Sebastian or if he just feels like a manly brotherhood with him.
Right.
But Antonio's a very active, masculine character. Like, he's going out and putting himself in danger. He's giving money to Sebastian.
Right.
He's, like, he's taking action. And so it's kind of interesting that, like, he loves this man, but he's not, like, the wimpy gay character. Like, he's an action hero, kind of.
A dashing man of action.
Yeah.
A dangerous, hairy pirate.
You can even say that same thing about Viola. I mean, Viola. She's the more active, masculine character here, too. Okay? In that sort of love triangle of Orsino and Olivia. She's the active one.
She's going places and doing things and having passions.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And maybe this is what attracts Olivia to her.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's just a lot of room to play around there. And I think probably when, like, a modern-day student reads this play, a lot of people are like, is Antonio gay? Because he's just straight up like, I love you.
Right.
Right.
He's not ashamed at all. And
okay, coming from the teacher's perspective, that's another half an hour lesson.
Yeah.
Right.
Question.
And you have to say, like, well, no, he's not gay, because people back then were not gay.
They,
it wasn't a thing.
Sexuality being defined was basically not a thing.
Yeah.
Even if you, like, loved men or, well, I mean, like, even being in love with a man, like, in a romantic sense, wasn't really a thing.
Right.
So there's a whole can of worms to go with that. But I just think that's an interesting thing about Antonio. Yeah, and the fact that he gives Sebastian his purse becomes an important plot point.
Right.
When Duke Orsino's men do find him, and he asks Viola for his purse, and she's like, I don't know what you're talking, I have a little bit of money.
Yeah, right.
And then he's like, oh, you betrayed me, and all that stuff, so.
Well, maybe he's so into Sebastian, because Sebastian is, by action, at least in this play, the ultimate dashing man of action.
Clearly.
Yeah.
He gets jumped by a knight and a noble, who is a guy presumably trained to use a weapon, and he kicks the shit out of both of them.
True.
Two on one, not even worried.
And when the hot girl hits on him, he's just like, let's go have sex.
Exactly. All right, let's do this.
He's seriously, he's like a character out of a modern action movie.
Yeah. He's like Bruce Willis.
Oh, God.
It's like Jason Statham.
Okay, now let's see if we could actually stage that and think of the woman who would be mistaken for Jason Statham.
Oh, God.
But let's follow that through.
Huh. The problem with the modern action hero is, like, the whole thing with modern male action heroes in movies is they often be, like, insanely ripped.
Yeah,
right.
And so you could never do, like, insanely ripped man and his sister who looks exactly like him. Right. 'Cause that would cause some issues.
It's like, hey, they both have well-muscled arms. They're their personal trainer, but his are three times the circumference.
Did that, like, come out of the wall or something?
Try the bottom.
Okay.
Sorry.
It's all good.
Technical difficulties.
Okay, we're good.
Does it say tech support here?
So it'd have to be more like a, I don't know, old school action hero that wasn't as ripped. Although, like, Schwarzenegger was like...
Yeah, we're
like, like Sly Stallone?
Well, I guess Adam Sandler.
Adam Sandler's not an action hero.
The Cusack siblings?
Joan and John started 12 that. Amazing.
That probably would be pretty fun.
Oh my God.
I would see that.
Wow.
I probably would too.
Or Maggie and Jake Gyllenhaal.
Penny and Gary Marshall?
I don't even know this people.
They're old and one of them's not even an actor.
Okay.
a director and his sibling.
Are you doing the guy who directed Chicago? Gary Marshall?
He didn't do Chicago, did he?
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
I think so.
I don't know. I mostly think of the Paul F. Tompkins character when I think of Gary Marshall.
Oh, whatever. Okay. Moving on. Yeah, so I guess... On the sexuality realm, so I was just talking about Antonio and some of the kind of gray areas there. You also have, like we were saying, so Viola dressed as a boy, mm-hmm. She's in love with Orsino, mm-hmm. Olivia's in love with her male counterpart version.
And then what do you make of the fact that Orsino suddenly falls in love with her at the end and declares, "You will now be my mistress."
Has never seen her as a girl.
Yeah, has never seen her as a girl whatsoever. Has only ever known Viola as Cesario.
And then Olivia, like, when she finds out that Cesario is a woman, she doesn't seem disturbed by that at all.
No, not really.
She's just like, oh, okay, that's kind of cool. Yeah. Like, sister, I kind of get the feeling she's kind of into that.
Yeah, you know, a sister, you are she, or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. No one's kind of going, oh, I was in love with a woman? Maybe that's a thing?
Should that worry me? Well, Viola says, I mean, the reveal at the end basically goes, Viola, I'm a girl, and Orsino, I only have your word for that, but you can be my mistress.
Awesome. Yeah, let's get married.
And Olivia
says,
you're a chick?
Did she say, oh, wonderful, or how wonderful?
How wondrous, I think.
She's like, awesome. She's like, awesome. A girl who looks just like her brother. I think they're both hot.
I'm into that.
I'm way into that.
Olivia's
most wonderful. That's
most wonderful. Most wonderful. That's even better.
Most wonderful.
Oh, Olivia's the one who's going, Twins!
Twins! Oh, great. Now I see that in my mind.
Twins!
And Sebastian and Viola are like...
Awkward marital conversations years down the road.
I think part of that's probably because, like Tony was talking about, Twelfth Night, the time where, like, you know, poppers can dress up as kings and, like, everything's topsy-turvy and, like, right. anything goes. And in this case, like, gender and sexuality are kind of like a big whatever right. stew.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't really matter if it was...
Yeah. I mean, it's all about inversion in the play because Twelfth Night was a night of festivals, a night when, you know, the bottom became the social bottom became the top of the social hierarchy. You have the infant king, the boy bishops, And it was this idea that all those sort of social pressures that kind of built up throughout the year of being, you know, more of a repressed class get released. You suddenly get to just go wild.
Yeah.
Okay? And this was a way to keep people from revolting all the time.
Excuse me. So here's a situation where it's like, oh, I was like, in love with a guy who's actually a girl. Oh, whatever. It's 12.
Yeah.
It's 12. Right. Yeah, anything goes.
It's spring break.
Yeah. Spring break. Woo! That would totally be modern day 12.
That's what it would be. Oh.
Spring break. Yep.
Spring. Yeah, that could
they
work.
They all go to Elyria for spring break.
But how would you do the bathing suits?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Let me figure it out.
Good question. We can work on that.
There's a way around it, I'm sure.
When are we going to start our new career writing scripts for college comedies based on classics?
On classics. Soon. Very, very
soon. It seems like every time we discuss a classic, we have these moments.
And they're always great.
And they are usually pretty fantastic. It sounds like a real movie.
12th night set in Cancun, spring break.
That's right.
It's like Clueless as an adaptation of Emma.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Like, it works.
Yeah.
Or 1,000 Shakespeare plays have been adapted into 1,000 movies named different things.
Mm-hmm. Right, like, you can basically set a Shakespeare play whenever, whatever.
Right.
As long as you're kind of keeping the... Yeah, so... Okay. So the sexuality aspect, we talked a little about the feminism of, like, the female characters actually getting, like, empowerment and mm-hmm. prominence. And actually, there was one thing I wanted to mention there with Mariah.
Oh, yeah.
Because when they're like, man, we fucking hate that guy, she's like, I can, you know, write these letters that'll trick him. And, like, she just does it on her own. And then they're like, you're a genius.
Right. Well, and she gets rewarded at the end.
Yeah,
she
Toby just says,
Sir Toby.
This letter is so amazing, I would marry you just for writing it. And then he does.
Yeah, he totally does.
Exactly. It's like, I thought that was just hyperbole.
That guy takes his comedy seriously.
You know, I'm following through with this.
He's like, you are hilarious.
He's like, how funny is it? All right, I got to do it.
Yeah. So do you think
For the laws.
Do you think, like, Toby and Mariah just run off and, like, fuck with everyone they meet?
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah, what if Toby's a little brighter than we give him credit for, and they're both just giant trolls?
Because Mariah is, like, pretty... I mean, like, you know, she's kind of a comic character and a little ridiculous in her own right too. Right. Like Toby and Andrew and stuff. But she's, like, definitely much brighter than Andrew.
Oh, God, yeah.
She totally pulls the wool over Malvolio's eyes. She kind of manipulates the guys to a certain degree and, like, recognizes the foibles that are going on. So, like, she's...
Yeah, she orchestrates the whole subplot, really.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So she plays a prominent role there. That's pretty cool. I guess because we were talking about Puritanism or about Malvolio being a Puritan.
Yeah.
Do you just like want to
give more context to that? So Malvolio is the first stage representation of a Puritan. Puritans were those sort of sect of the English church that didn't think the English church reformed enough from the Catholic church. So they kept wanting to, quote, purge the Anglican church of all the rags of Rome. They wanted to keep going further with the Reformation. They were very much against the theater. They wrote lots and lots of pamphlets condemning the theater because it promoted homosexuality, it promoted licentiousness, it distracted people from the church, so on and so forth. And at the end, when Malvolio says, I will have my revenge on the pack of you, you know, we could really take that line very, very prophetically, because in 1642... when the Puritans actually did take over Parliament and start the English Civil War, they closed down the theaters, okay, and they actually canceled Christmas because, you know, they felt that it was too pagan in origin and had the word Mass in it, which represented, you know, which was a callback to more Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
So, in a way, Malvolio does have his revenge on everybody.
In the form of Oliver Cromwell.
In the form of Oliver Cromwell. Dick.
And the pilgrims who sailed over to America were all Puritans, right?
Yes, they were.
So, we also have that.
Yeah.
By the way.
That's a streak of humorless dick running through the American culture.
The Salem witch trials happened because Puritans are freaks.
When you see people protesting a Harry Potter movie or book release, thanks, Puritans!
Yay! Yeah, they all go back to Malvolio, so maybe he did deserve it.
Yeah, that's right.
Those people are obnoxious.
Maybe they should have been meaner to him.
I'll be honest, think of it this way. The Puritans were probably literally protesting right outside the theaters on these sort of soapboxes. Yeah. They would have been the Westboro Baptist Church.
Of their day.
Right.
They really would have been.
You get to go into the theater and, like, see them getting ridiculed on stage.
Yeah,
actors burn in hell!
Yeah, exactly.
We're like, what? We're just providing entertainment.
No, burn in hell! So, yeah, they probably felt, Malvolio, not punished enough.
Yeah. You're the dick.
See?
Do you still feel sorry for him, Ben?
Less and less.
I mean, it really makes a lot of sense, like, if you think about it in the context, as opposed to just like, oh, here's this kind of a character who's kind of a dick, and then people are mean to him. Like, if you take it in the context of, here's Puritanism in Shakespeare's time, and he's a Puritan character.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, to anyone who's listening to this, one of the reasons I like having Tony on is that reading a Shakespeare play in a vacuum is, like, a really dangerous idea.
Oh, God, yes, it is.
I had a professor in college who, like, used to rail against that constantly because he's like, half of this crap you don't even understand unless you study the Elizabethan times and the historical context. Like, you don't even know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is, like, one of those instances where, like, you could read the play and draw your own conclusions, but if you don't actually know it was intended, then...
Yeah, you have to have some historical context, you know, for the jokes, for the social commentary that's being made. And even for the cross-dressing, I mean, there was a fad in Shakespeare's London for women to cross-dress. I mean, they were called hic mulieres, and they would actually go around dressed as men, get their hair cut as men, and would have, you know, rapiers with them.
And actually, one of the things I was reading about when I was doing research for my thesis is there were some, like, women who would, like, dress as a man and act as a man.
Mm-hmm.
If you were, like, dedicated enough to that, sometimes they let you get married to a woman.
Yeah.
Because when they didn't understand how reproduction worked, they actually thought a vagina was an inverted penis.
Yes.
And that if, like, a woman was manly enough, her penis would basically, like, fall out and she would become a man.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, female, like, not lesbian couples, because they wouldn't have thought of themselves as lesbian, but basically, like, female romantic couples could get married if one of them, like, went out into society and, like, passed as a man, essentially.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It was based off of the second century anatomist Galen,
mm-hmm.
who basically said, yeah, it was the male, or the female anatomy is just the inversion of the male anatomy, because women don't have enough vital heat to finish becoming a male having a male body.
So of course. Seen,
of course,
well,
right.
It's not from Aristotle,
yeah.
So they're seen as imperfect.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's really kind of cool. You can get away with that.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And that makes Viola, like, the fact that she's, like, kind of masculine in the play and taking action, like, she's kind of a reflection of that
absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe she and Olivia could have gotten together if she wanted to, like, stay as Cesario.
Wait, I'm dreaming about that right now. Sorry. That's hot.
It's too bad Viola liked that foppish pretty boy or something.
Maybe she liked him because he was kind of feminine and she's pretty masculine. So they fit together.
This is getting very complicated.
I know, when you bring queer theory and it's really fun. There's so much crazy stuff you can do. And then one of the other things, so we've talked about how, Viola never actually, you know, becomes Viola again, like,
right,
all the way,
mm-hmm.
and there's not a marriage at the end. I think Sebastian and Olivia actually do get married.
Yes.
But...
Well, yeah, they're married in the play.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, yeah, you see it.
Yeah.
What am I talking about? But Viola and Orsino don't.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Malvolio's kind of, like, curse, and then he runs off, and so we are left with that open end, and mm-hmm. so that's this kind of Was this his last comedy, or
It's one of the later ones. It's written in 1600-1601. Okay, so it's this sort of... He's making a transition in his career from his earlier comedies into his later romances, and this is seen as that sort of transitionary play where you have elements of both the comedy and the romance.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the comedy aspect of, like, just the straight-up goofy characters.
Goofy characters, you know, the mistaken identity with the twins, all elements of the comedy, but then towards the... Moving into the romances, you have the shipwreck.
Mm-hmm.
You have these visitors in a strange land that are kind of, they're, you know, rather...
It's kind of this danger.
Yeah, it's
like
a rather dangerous area. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And then it doesn't end completely tied up, so then exactly. That's also kind of on the romance vein of things. Because mm-hmm. Those plays do not just...
No, they don't.
...wrap up tidily. Alrighty. And you know what? I think I accidentally, like, just erased themes off of the thing. Because I remember you were talking about melancholy as a theme, and I was going to put it down, and then I didn't. You want to talk about that? Or just say it's a theme of the play?
Melancholy is a theme of the play. It's a big theme.
I mean, yeah, the big theme going on is just that, like, pretty much nothing is as it seems, and it's kind of all messed up, and it's... Mm-hmm. Moving towards something else. Sorry about that. So let's see. Points of interest. There was... We kind of talked about it. The scene where Malvolio finds the letter that Mariah drops.
Right.
Which is actually, when you see it performed,
is hilarious.
Hilarious, yeah.
Going, oh, these are the letters. These letters are in my name, in no particular order.
Right. Yeah, M-O-A-I.
They must be addressed to me.
Right, but if I just crush them together enough, has to be addressed to me. Yeah.
Or when he finds it and he says, these are her C's, her U's, and her T's.
Yes.
Because Shakespeare loves a good vagina.
Right. Yeah.
and Andrew's like, what?
Like, what the hell are you talking about?
Well, there's some of those letters aren't even in the opening script that's on the envelope.
Yeah.
Right, so, yeah.
Yeah, he's just making a sex joke.
God damn Shakespeare.
But yeah, that scene's a really good demonstration of, like, how Malvolio is actually completely ridiculous.
Yeah.
Because at first he's just, like, you know, stubborn, moody guy. Mm-hmm. And then when he finds that letter, and that letter itself is super ridiculous, and then he reads so much into it, and you're like, oh, this guy really is just completely full of himself. Yeah. And, like...
Well, right before that, Marias says he's been gesturing to his shadow, practicing his speeches. And he... And, yeah, even before he reads the letter, he goes into that fantasy he has about marrying Olivia and how this will elevate him, and he'll tell everybody else, I know my place as well, you should know your place.
He calls in Toby and, like, yes, tells him that he has to...
amend your drunkenness.
Yeah.
It's like, fuck you.
And Fabian and Toby are watching him and just, like, they keep, like, snide little comments, right. Like, fuck you. They keep talking about they're going to kill him and stuff.
That's true.
It's a little extreme. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go stab him with my sword. And Mariah's like, calm down.
He's like, I could marry Olivia. And they're like, we're going to cut his guts out and wear him as a belt.
Whoa.
Whoa. He goes from zero to guts for garters and, like, a drop the hat.
So is Toby Belch kind of like a Falstaff?
Yeah, he's a Falstaffian character, absolutely.
Okay. So that's the comparison I was going to make, but just make sure I wasn't being a dope.
No, you're not being. No, I'll tell you when you are.
I guess any final commentary or thoughts?
Go see this play if you have the chance. If you don't, there's a great film production by Trevor Nunn from 1998 that stars
Helena Bonham Carter as Olivia.
Ben Kingsley as Festy.
Uh-huh.
Nigel Hawthorne plays Malvolio.
Yes, yeah. I don't remember. I don't even remember who Orsino is.
No name. He never
some,
really
some guy.
Some guy. Imogen Stubbs plays Viola.
And isn't Mariah played by...
Yeah, the
actress who plays Umbridge.
Yes, she... Yes.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah, she actually is, yeah.
Okay, then.
Yeah, actually, one of the things I realized watching esteemed productions of, like, Shakespeare movies is that a lot of British Shakespearean actors are in the Harry Potter movies.
Oh, God, yeah.
It's crazy. You're like, wait a minute. What is going on
They're
here?
Natural allies.
So any comments on the strengths and weaknesses of the writing, since we do like to,
Can I say it?
Do it.
Yo, it's fucking Shakespeare.
Yeah, and one of the things with Shakespeare, as Tony said, like, if you can go rent the movie or go see a stage version, he really is meant to be watched and heard. Because you don't read Shakespeare because the plot's so crazy and intriguing. Like, you want to see what the characters are saying. Right. Like, when you study Shakespeare in class, you're not studying plot. You're studying, here's, like, a 10-line speech. And, like, how is this speech revealing the character? And, like, what kinds of figurative language is being used? And, like, once you unpack the language, there's, like, a ton of shit
going on.
There
really is, yeah.
So, that's really why you still read Shakespeare, not because, like...
Yeah, or you look at, you know, what's he doing with this particular genre? You know, how's he reinventing the comedy here? Or the revenge tragedy in Hamlet, right? But you don't read for plot.
Yeah, you're not just reading it because it's a rip-roaring good plot.
Just so you know, Shakespeare, all but four of Shakespeare's plays, the plot comes from somewhere else.
So what's Twelfth Night?
Twelfth Night comes from a Roman...
So it's comedy theirs.
Yeah, it's called Apollonius and Scylla. And there you go.
Beat.
So
thoughts sneeze.
So Fox. Questions we have for the play.
Well, in the sequel, does Malvolio get his horrible revenge?
Yeah. What happens to Malvolio?
What's the wedding night like for Orsino and Viola?
Yeah, just kind of in general, like, how did those relationships turn out?
Does he want her to still wear her Cesario costume while they're in bed?
Olivia want Sebastian to pretend to be Cesario?
Yeah.
What's going on there?
Does Antonio and Sebastian go into business together running, like, a trading company?
Does Antonio find a nice man?
That's right. Did he find a man who won't marry a stranger at the drop of a hat?
Ben, what's your verdict?
It was pretty funny. I would love to see it staged. And my complaint going back several years still stands of why do we study the Shakespeare plays we study in school? Because I feel like every time, the couple of times I've read one outside of school, I've enjoyed it more. And I don't know if that's because I'm, you know, less dumb about,
you're not 16.
About things that high school students are dumb about.
No, Ben, that's not the case.
Or if there's a sophistication element, or if it's a way, or if it's the way they're, if it's the way they're taught, how it, almost every book you read in high school becomes a drag, even when it's good.
Yeah.
But like, there is a lot to love in the language. There's a lot of really funny interactions in this play, and I was going, wow, I can catch these without running it through the filter of an English teacher. Would I have been able to do that when I was 16? I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, you're kind of somewhat trained to read it now.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm a lot more equipped to deal with it. I'm not freaked out by the language like I would have been 15 years ago.
And that's why, like, you know, yeah, hearing it spoken is not reading it in class when it's incomprehensible gibberish because no one knows what the fuck they're doing.
Or you're reading it aloud in class and everyone's reading it like...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, the teacher has, like, a 20-minute lesson on how to read Shakespeare. Don't pause it at the end of every line. Right. Do this and this and this. And then everyone's like, and then he's...
Wherefore are these things hid? Wherefore have these gifts a curtain before, you're like, God damn it! Learn to
you
read.
You are butchering Shakespeare.
But if you actually are, you know, like, professional actors who, like, know what they're saying, then...
Right.
There's a lot to be heard in there. So, I think that's really helpful.
Gabs, what's your verdict?
I really like this play. It's one of my favorites of the Shakespeare plays. I think it's really funny, and I mean, just kind of for my own, like, interests and purposes, like, when I was studying, like, queer theory and interpretations and stuff, like, this play is really fun for that.
Yeah, yes, it is.
A lot of crazy stuff going on. So I really like that aspect of it as well.
Cool.
All right. What are we reading right now?
You want to start?
Sure. I'm reading the Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn and Phil K. Dick's Simulacra.
All right. Well, I'm reading Transcendent by Stephen Baxter, which is a blend of near future ecological disaster and far future, well, like super far future evolutionary scale. Somehow the two are linked, but I don't know how yet. I'm not far enough into the book.
I'm reading The Story of Edgar Sawtell by David Robluski. I don't actually know the guy's last name. The way I described it to these guys was, it's a modern day retelling of Hamlet, but with dogs.
With dogs.
And not like the dogs are the main characters, but there are dogs in the book. And they're very important.
In the kennel.
So, Tony, do you want to go ahead and give your little plug?
Sure. Come visit my blog at The Mad Literature Professor. Can you put the link up on your blog or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So click on that link. Do it.
Well,
do it now.
What's it about? Should I read it?
Why should you read it? It's my musings on typical pieces of literature that you'll encounter in an intro to literature course. So, you know, if you ever read, if you ever read the Yellow Wallpaper, there's a couple of different blog posts just going over that, you know?
We did read the Yellow Wallpaper.
Yes, you did. So, fun times.
Okay.
All right, well, if anyone has comments, questions, or random sacks of words to dump over our heads, you can leave a comment on our website, novelideaspodcast.com.
You can email us, novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
We're on Twitter, @novelideaspod.
And you can also find us on iTunes.
And if you do that, like, rate and review and write shit.
Write shit.
Like, literally shit?
Yeah.
Just write.
This was shit.
Well, give us 5 stars.
5 stars, comment, shit.
Shit. I don't know what to believe then.
What are you
I would love to get like 100 of those. That would be amazing.
Just people in 5 stars and shit.
Shit.
That's
shit.
All it says.
Shit. Shit.
What is happening?
Huh? I don't know.
Please do that. And I actually just remembered this little plug that I wanted to give on YouTube. There is a series of videos called Thug Notes. And it's these people who produce these, like, 3 to 5 minute videos about classic works of literature. They did Hamlet, Romeo and Juliet for Shakespeare. And it's basically the guy who's giving the talk, his name is Sparky Sweets, PhD. And he's a quote-unquote thug, so, like, you know, kind of, he uses, like, the language. But he gives, like, a summary of the work and then an analysis. And it's actually a really intelligent...
Oh, cool.
Like, the... I read a thing about the people who create it, and they actually have, like, an English lit person who works on the videos who, like, they work with him, and they actually pull out the important themes and symbols and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's actually, like, intelligent commentary, okay. But, like, in a goofy way, and I love it.
Okay.
It's very entertaining, and actually a lot of the Thug Notes... videos have been Novel Ideas episodes.
Perfect.
So if you like To Kill a Mockingbird, you can go watch it on YouTube as well. So that was just a little plug. I've been watching a lot of that lately. I just want to give a little plug for that.
All right, great. Well, thank you for listening. Next week, we will be...
We're actually going to be doing Angels in America.
Yes, Angels in America by Tony Kushner.
We're going to do it this week, but it's a little hard to get a hold of, so...
This schedule got all cattywampus. as no one says. So we'll look forward to seeing you next time.
All right. Bye. Tis not hereafter, present mirth hath bred.